Hi, and welcome to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutan. This is the show that brings you the most important conversations of the day. Yesterday, we talked about education. We talked about STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and math. And we had a panel discussion on it. And today, we're going to continue that, but looking at just one of those elements, math. So mathematics, if you want to be pedantic about it. Now, the person I have with me is very interesting because he's a teacher at Cherrybrook Technology High School in Sydney. He's a YouTube sensation with hundreds of thousands of subscribers to his YouTube channel. And last year, he won Australia's Local Hero Award at the Australian of the Year Awards. And who am I talking about? I'm talking about Eddie Wu. Eddie Wu, thank you so much for joining me this evening.
Sharad, it's my pleasure.
Okay, I know you've had a very busy day speaking to lots of people, engaging with lots of Malaysians. But tell us about that a bit of you, since let's get to know you a little. I know your parents moved from Malaysia to Australia sometime in the 70s. Mm. You were born in the 80s.
Correct.
Made you extraordinarily young, somebody so successful. In fact, in March last year, you were named as a top 10 finalist of the Global Teacher Prize. Now, that's the reason you're on the show, because in our focus on education, we know that teachers are extraordinarily important. Mm. Now, tell us, and TEDx, I believe, you did a little talk on TEDx, and you explained some of this. But for people who hadn't seen that, tell us about your journey, a journey that took you from the love of English literature and history into math.
I'm definitely not what you would expect as a stereotypical mathematics teacher, even though perhaps on paper, you know, by my appearance, you might jump to a quick conclusion. But when I was in high school, it was the humanities that I always loved the most. I was an avid reader. I chalked that down partly to the fact that I'm the youngest of three children. My brother and sister are quite close in age. And then after a while, there was me. And my brother and sister could...
You were an afterthought. Maybe.
Yeah. That's the way I viewed myself, to be honest. My brother and sister could always do very similar things. They could go and watch the same movies. They could engage in the same sports. And I was always too small, too uncoordinated. And so, in many ways, I turned to books as something which I could enjoy and I could do on my own. And so, history and English and subjects like that, which really lean towards those reading skills, that's where I was most naturally at home, at least to begin with.
Okay, so this is a really interesting setup, because then there's this move into mathematics in the field, because you wanted to be a teacher, and you wanted to be a teacher of English literature and history. Now, that framework, before we get to the maths issue, being somebody who loves books and stories and such, did that shape the way that you are? Because you clearly become a communicator. Mm. And that is, I think, one of the chief characteristics of who you are as a person today. How does that, because it seems to me we often talk about STEM education and STEM subjects as kind of apart from history, which is now devalued, and English and literature that's also devalued. How do you see that?
I do think it's a real shame that unfortunately there's become a bit of a false dichotomy between these different styles of learning, which were always intended to be complementary and to touch on different parts of human knowledge and human understanding. But as a consequence of schools being very, you know, structured, and we have specialists in this subject and that subject, I think we've somewhat lost touch with each other. I mean, I'll give you a classic example. In my school, in the staff room that I sit in, we have all the mathematics teachers gathered in one spot. And then beside them, in a separate area, we have the creative and performing arts teachers. We have the musicians, the dancers, the artists. And this section being separate from mathematics, to me, is heartbreaking, because there is so much mathematics in music. When we think about rhythm and melody and harmony, all of that is mathematical. And I could continue that list. The sciences are rich with mathematics. And when we think about history and the understanding of statistics and where history is going today, economics, whenever you dig into something, you can find mathematics there. So I think that's a distraction to think of them as separate things. It's really important for us to recover that unity, in fact.
Okay, you've been quite public about how bad you were at math at an early age, right? In fact, you went so far as to say, math was not really my thing, but stories, characters, narratives. You said those are things that where you feel most at home. So how did it happen that you found this in math?
There was a very circuitous journey that I took to get to mathematics. And as you mentioned before, it really came through my love, or the love that I grew, of education and learning and teaching. I had a great opportunity at high school to engage in lots of extracurricular activities. So I was things like an army cadet. I was what we call a peer support leader in Australia. So as younger students come into the school, I would be one of the students who would mentor them and look after them, help them adjust to the new school environment. And by doing things like that, I realized that I loved interacting with younger children. I loved helping them learn skills that they thought were impossible for them to reach otherwise. As an army cadet, we'd do simple things like how to pitch a tent, or how to navigate your way through the mountainside. Things that are very intimidating for young children, but with the right support and guidance, they can learn these skills. That's what set me on the path to becoming a teacher. And when I got to university, I realized that there was a huge need in mathematics, a huge shortage. I understand one that's not that dissimilar to here in Malaysia. And because my love of teaching came from making an impact on the lives of young people, it wasn't my particular love for a discipline over another one. I realized if there's a need here, if there's a shortage, if there's somewhere I can supply a useful service, then mathematics is the place to go.
Okay, you know, you make a joke about the stereotype of the Asian Australian or somebody of Asian descent, right, getting into math. But getting into teaching would be something, I think, here, where there are a lot of people who don't think teaching is a career path to success. They often think of teaching as lowly paid with long hours and very repetitive. What would be your plug for the teaching profession? I mean, why should somebody who's bright and articulate and full of passion like yourself or anyone get into teaching?
There are so many ways that I could justify the whole idea of teaching, but I would highlight probably three things. I'm leaning very much on not just my own experience, but the research of people like Dan Pink. Dan Pink's done a lot of psychological research into the area of motivation. What is it that keeps people motivated long-term in, you know, whatever kind of pursuit or hobbies or profession that they go into? And he talks in particular about three qualities that I find really fascinating. He talks about autonomy, mastery, and purpose. And these are things which all human beings know, no matter what field they go into, no matter what hobbies they pursue, we want to have some sense of control. We want to have some flexibility and the ability to choose our own direction, some autonomy over how we do things. We want to gain a sense of mastery as well. There are a few things as satisfying as developing and increasing in our skill and saying, yes, this is something I have a skill for. I have expertise in this area. And then, of course, we want what we do to count. We want it to have a long-term impact. We want there to be a purpose for which we can say at the end of our lives, yes, that was worthwhile.
Well, okay, I get that about teachers. Teachers can be of tremendous consequence for the lives of young people. Right? We all remember our favorite teachers and so on and so forth. Autonomy is not something I would associate with the teaching profession, partly because of the curriculum. It seems that many teachers are tied to that curriculum, especially in countries like ours, where, you know, where the education system is fairly authoritarian, as the government had been for many years, right? And now we see a real attempt to change it. Why would you associate teaching with autonomy?
I knew that question was coming, Sharad, and I walked right into it. You're right. And to be fair, as a mathematics teacher, I think, obviously I'm somewhat biased, but I think there are few syllabuses, few curriculum areas that are as detailed and as prescriptive as the mathematics syllabus. And despite that fact, I think there is enormous space for autonomy. I'll give you a quick example. When I teach my students about the physical concepts that are part of mathematics, things like motion, displacement, velocity, acceleration, I am mandated to teach this particular equation. I need to teach this method for solving a problem. Yes, those are very specific and very, you know, regimented in some ways. However, what is the way that I'm going to engage my students to help them understand those concepts? Am I going to show them all of the equations on the board, lay down all the theory, and then show them a series of problems they can now see in the real world to do with astronomy or to do with vehicles moving around a racetrack? Well, I do it that way. Maybe I won't even talk about theory at all. Maybe the first thing I'll do is I'll take my students out into the playground and we'll throw tennis balls and basketballs and different objects around, and we will observe the patterns. We'll film it, we'll put it in slow motion, and then we'll watch as these objects trace perfect mathematical lines through the sky. I could go on and on and on. I really have true autonomy within my own class context to take those specific ideas, but allow my students to experience it in a way that actually makes sense to them.
Were you an outlier in school as a teacher? Were you doing too much? Were you the overachieving teacher?
I wouldn't say so. I think one of the great hallmarks of the Australian education system is how wonderfully stocked we are with very skilled and passionate and dedicated teachers. And probably what I've been able to do has become a little more visible just because of the use of the internet and what's accessible now through YouTube. But I'm delighted. I get to go to teacher conferences and meet other colleagues who are, they put me to shame, to be honest. So I'm one of many teachers who are very professional.
Okay, we're going to continue this conversation. Stay tuned to Let's Talk. My guest tonight, Eddie Wu.
I'm a teacher because I find joy in seeing children grow, opening their eyes to the world around them, and helping them find their unique place in it. I film my lessons every day so that no matter who you are or where you live, you can access the world of mathematics and learn from it. And mathematics, I love teaching it. It's amazing because it's woven into every part of our lives. From the algorithms that make modern technology work to the beautiful spiral of seeds in a sunflower. Embracing mathematics is a way to help us appreciate and understand the world in a deeper and richer way than any of us could ever have imagined.
Welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutin. My guest tonight, Eddie Wu, Australia's leading mathematics educator and communicator. And you know, that video we saw just now, perfect example of the kind of things that you do. I want to ask you about the schools that we left the conversation just now on schools, and you said Australian schools are places where people go, teachers who choose that as their vocation, you know, inspired to help their young people. But it seems like a lot of us went through school, whether in Malaysia or elsewhere, with a rather negative view of math in particular, right? We all felt we were not good enough for it and we were failing it and such. Is it because of what the schools are doing that mathematics is taught in a way that actually puts young people off?
Sharad, I think you really touch on a nerve there, because when a lot of people meet me and they find out I'm a mathematics teacher, I generally get one of two responses. Every now and then, I have someone who says, oh, that's great, I'm an engineer, I'm an actuary, I loved mathematics when I was at school, good on you, you're doing great work. That happens about one in every 100 times that I meet people. The other 99, I do find people who are very, very quick to say, oh, they don't just say I hated mathematics, they say I hate mathematics, present tense. And as we talk and as we converse and I explain what it is that I think mathematics is, if I have enough time to have a chat with them, they often leave the conversation realizing that it's not mathematics that they hated. It was actually the way that they learned it, which was negative, which was inaccessible, and it alienated them, in fact, from a subject which they can embrace, and they realize sometimes, much later than they wanted to, that this is something they missed out on at school.
Okay, before we get to the students, I just want to know, if you could turn somebody like me around, could you, and I was very inspired by your TED Talk, by the way, the idea that math is all around us, could you make adults have left school, you know, a long time ago, love math again, see it as something that they could be fascinated by?
I'd like to say that I'll try. I mean, for me, I think that mathematics is something which I know from my own journey, something that cannot be appreciated early on, but in fact can be slowly developed. I'd compare it a little bit to developing a taste for a certain food. You know, when I was little, I was a really fussy eater. I caused enormous problems for my mom. I just said, I don't want to eat that, I don't want to eat that. Today, I only eat blue food. You know, I was really difficult to work for and to provide food for. But then, you know, as I grew and as I matured and as I deliberately gave myself opportunities to try new and different things, I was able to expand my palate. And of course, I've benefited from that more diverse willingness to eat food. Now, with mathematics, I think that the same is true. You know, I made this comparison to food. Let me make this comparison to music. Most people would say, yeah, I enjoy music, I enjoy a particular kind of music, but if all you ever experienced was one style, maybe it was just classical, maybe it was just pop, or maybe it was dubstep, whichever one it was, if that was the only one that people ever heard out in the world, you wouldn't be surprised that most people would say, actually, I don't like that. Classical music, not my thing, just for a very small subset of the population. But if what we can do is actually show the diversity of musical flavors that are out there, you'll eventually find your pocket, and it's the same with maths. If there's someone who's very interested in the legal system, in justice, you know, mathematics is in there. Did you realize? I learned this actually not that long ago myself, that in the judicial system, when we determine, okay, someone perhaps is guilty, we need to determine what will be the length of their sentence. We have mathematical algorithms designed to help us be more just, more fair, unbiased, to help us make those decisions and be fair and equitable and create a system that produces a just society. There's mathematics in the legal system.
Right, and that would be a new invention, right? I guess you'd rely on the judge who would have precedent, who would remember how sentencing was meted out in the earlier practice. Okay, let's go back to the school, and what is it the schools are doing wrong when it comes to math? What is it they're not telling either the teachers or the students that's turning this into a rather torturous experience for young people?
There's a few things I could point to. I mean, amidst all of the great work that is happening in many schools, we insist on focusing in many places still on a process-focused view of mathematics. Well, what does this look like? I'll say, Sharad, we're going to learn the quadratic formula today, okay? I want you to memorize x equals minus b plus or minus the square root of b. I can already see you starting to glaze over.
Try surds. I hated surds.
Sure, right? So I'm going to give you this formula, and I'm going to expect you to be able to perform, put the numbers in, get a number out. You might say, why am I doing this? I'm going to say, Sharad, don't ask me why. Just do it. That's what matters. In the exam, you don't need to tell me why. You need to be able to answer the question. And in fact, by doing that, sadly, we actually short-circuit our students' ability to develop that purpose part of motivation. Are we surprised that they are unmotivated when they have no reason to actually engage with these very difficult abstract ideas? If instead I said to you, you know what we're trying to do here is solve problems that matter financially, that matter in terms of perhaps you love sports, and trying to work out where am I going to hit this golf swing or where am I going to kick this ball, I'm trying to solve a problem that matters to you, and I can use this particular method to do it. Now you have a purpose for it. That, I see, is something that's missing in many schools.
Right, okay. But we learned to count more than just using our fingers and toes and such, right? I mean, math, there's a level of abstraction in math, isn't it? I mean, is that a skill too? I mean, if everything is applied in terms of, you know, daily activities, are you missing out on some other dimension of math?
Right, so one of the strengths of mathematics, but it ends up being also a two-edged sword. There's a danger to it, which I'll explain in a second. One of the strengths of mathematics is that it applies to a completely broad range of things. You know, if you have a look at a shape like, I was talking about the quadratic formula before. This describes shapes we call parabolas. If you look at a fountain and you see the water arcing up through the air, it stops just at the top and then it comes down in this perfectly symmetrical shape. This is a parabola. Now, this is not the only place you find parabolas. If there's a comet that's approaching the sun and it whips around and we just see it from Earth for a little while and then it turns around and off it heads back into space again. Surprise, surprise, the same shape is traced out. And I could go on and on and on. The whole point of abstraction, saying instead of a fountain or instead of a comet, instead, I say x squared, and I leave you all these symbols which don't necessarily have a specific meaning. The point is to say these could be anything. They might not be these objects, they might be money, they might be electrical signals. But the problem is sometimes we forget to actually connect it to a context, and we must do that so our students appreciate what's the meaning of all this, why do we do it?
One of the things that you do say in your speech on TEDx is that in doing math, you're involved in a creative process, something that I don't think people associate with math. How is it creative?
What I want to seek to do here is to broaden what our sense of creativity is. In mathematics, I'll give you an example. We want to prove that things are true. It's really important to us that we can use logic and we can use reasoning and we can actually come to a point where we convince ourselves, not only is this maybe true, I can be rock solid true. I can send human beings into space and be so confident mathematically that they are going to go in exactly the trajectory to land on this moon and then come back safely. I'll bank on it. I'll bank these people's lives on it. And so when we're reasoning, when we're arguing mathematically, there may be one destination. There may be one result we want to prove or one answer we get to. But there are so many different paths to get there. In fact, that's how we gain certainty in mathematics. We prove things through a variety of different means, and it takes creativity to think of those different means. And that's not to mention, when we think about things like the arts, I mentioned music before, visual arts is intensely mathematical. All of the patterns and symmetry, all of those have mathematical foundations woven underneath them.
I think Carnatic music in southern India is also very mathematical. You talked about Islamic arts as well in your presentation as being very mathematical. We'll hold that thought. We'll come right back with Eddie Wu in a short time. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Eddie Wu. He's Australia's leading mathematics educator, communicator, YouTuber. I don't know if there's anybody bigger on YouTube in math than you in Australia. You have some 200 or so thousand followers.
I don't keep track.
Okay. What you do make an argument for is a new way of thinking about mathematics. You call it a sense. Mathematical thinking is a sense. Explain that to me.
So I don't mean this in a literal sense. It's a metaphor for me, but it's an incredibly powerful metaphor. And the reason why I like to describe it in this way is because there's a very traditional view of what mathematical skill is, and that's what educators often call a fixed mindset. And the fixed mindset is, you know what, Sharad, some people are just born with mathematical brains, and some people don't. And for the normal people who don't, we just sort of throw our hands up and we're helpless. Sorry, it's just not something I can do. Now, there are clear problems with that. We once upon a time could plead ignorance about what was happening physiologically in the brain, and we could pretend, there is such a thing as a maths brain. It's actually different in its structure. But now we know better. We have functional magnetic resonance imaging machines that these fMRIs look inside the brain as people are engaged in mathematics. There's no structural difference between people who are great at maths and people who are not. Now, in opposition to the idea of fixed mindset, there's a sort of other end of the extreme, a sort of a fluid mindset where it's almost like the brain is completely plastic. I can change it to be whatever I want. Anyone can be Einstein. Anyone can be Rachmaninoff and can do whatever they want with their brain, almost like a Disney movie. If Sharad, you'll only believe. Now, those are very extreme,
if I,
right?
If I get trained. And so what is, what is that taking, that extreme taking you to?
Now, that extreme, I think, it ends up, while it has some great strengths, because what it does say is, you know what, as opposed to this fixed idea, you can develop this mathematical skill. And I think that is demonstrably true. If you have a child and you help them and you provide support and you also assist them to regularly practice, surprise, surprise, they do develop mathematical skill that they didn't have before. So there is evidence to support that idea as a whole. But the problem is, you put this burden, you place this impossible expectation on students who perhaps may have a natural flair and an enjoyment in other areas, and you say, no, 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 but I expect you to be this. And so the reason why I love the idea, the metaphor of mathematics as a sense, is because it marries up these two ideas in a way that I hope does justice to what we are as human beings. Number one, it's true, there are some parts of us where there's a fixed idea of, I have great senses when it comes to taste, and I have terrible senses when it comes to eyes, like it looks like you share with me, Sharad. I actually...
Only knowledge.
Okay,
you're too young to have my problem. Okay.
I have a short-sighted eye and a long-sighted eye. It's very, very confusing. But while I have fixed limitations, physical limitations on my vision, that doesn't mean I can't actually refine my senses. And you know, I talked about my taste buds before. Those taste buds have changed over time. I have friends who over many, many years have become, you know, real wine connoisseurs. They go on tours, they drink this one and this one and this one, and they say, wow, this one's different. This is nice and fruity. This one's very dry. And I say, how can a wine be dry? It's wet, isn't it? This is something I clearly have not cultivated myself, but they have. I have some friends who are musical and they would listen to a note played on an instrument and they'll say, that's a C sharp. I said, how did you know that? They said, we've learned to develop perfect pitch. Now, the senses may be rooted in physical realities that some people are better than others, but they can be sharpened, they can be refined. Now, that's why I think mathematics is somewhere in the middle, neither fixed nor completely fluid, but like a sense that allows us to perceive the world and one we can actually grow.
Okay. Some people might say, well, actually, what math is a skill, right? It's about counting and, you know, counting fast. And I remember in school being taught, you know, having to memorize the times table, right? So you'd have to memorize, and I'm terrified because I always got it wrong. And the thing is it a skill? I mean, should we think of it as a skill that's necessary in later life and, you know, applied to other fields and so on and so forth?
I think that mathematics is a skill the same way that journalism is spelling. Clearly, it helps to be an accurate speller if you want to be an effective and respected journalist like you are, but that's clearly one narrow part of the broader skill set that we would say journalism is. We want our students to be good at arithmetic. We want them to be able to, you know, manipulate algebra without thinking too hard about it because it comes naturally to them, because they're fluent in it like a language. But that's just one small part of mathematical knowledge and growth. I mean, we want students also to be able to communicate their thinking, to reason, to be able to problem solve and meet a problem they've never encountered before, but still solve it. And that's more than just a skill.
Okay, so you talk about patterns, relationships, logical connections as that part of that skill set, right? Or that sense. Mm. What is it about patterns that is mathematical?
So we live in a patterned universe. I mean, one of the things that I am is obsessed with words and where they come from. And I didn't know this until recently, but cosmos, you know, a synonym, we say the universe is the cosmos, but actually cosmos means orderly and patterned. And the opposite of cosmos is chaos, which is disorderly and random. Now, when we live in a universe that is patterned, in which, you know, even when there are not patterns, human beings have been looking out at the night sky and all these stars, and we see constellations. But every culture in the world sees different constellations to the rest because we find different patterns in this sea of basically randomness. We are wired to see patterns, and whether they are natural ones, when we look out at a rainbow, when we say, rainbows, they're perfectly round. Why? There's a pattern there that's from the natural world, and there are patterns we create. I really enjoyed today. I actually got to go up to the Petronas Towers. I got right up onto the observation deck and just marveling at the geometry of this city. Clearly, the architecture and the design is hugely mathematical. And so whether it's the natural world or the created world, the constructed world, mathematics is everywhere, and it's always hard to avoid.
Okay, let's bring us back to the conversation we were having earlier about your background in literature and history. Now, you know, it seems that there's a hierarchy of knowledge, at least in the minds of people, and that math occupies part of the pinnacle, or close to the pinnacle of that, and something like history, for some people, are unimportant. As a teacher, from a pedagogical point of view, do you think that's mistaken? I mean, how do we locate these different knowledge and skill sets, you know, against each other?
I think coming back to that metaphor of senses actually will be really helpful here, because we have the five classical senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching. And we know that these all are, in fact, complementary. I don't think anyone would say, even though, of course, we are very much visual creatures and huge parts of the brain are devoted just to seeing, if seeing was the only sense we had, if we prized that among over and against every other sense, what a narrow and you know, impoverished view and experience of the world we would have. And so for me, I think it's really about having a rich view and experience, a diverse experience of the world. There are things that we cannot prove mathematically. We can only know them, for example, personally. We can only know them through culture. And so mathematics is a very powerful set of tools, but it has to be used in concert, in a complementary fashion with the other fields.
Okay, so would you say that the education system that says, let's emphasize STEM education, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, is mistaken?
Sir Ken Robinson is a wonderful voice for educators. And I think one of the things which he points out very clearly is how when we, you know, put an emphasis on, for example, those particular disciplines that allow us to solve practical problems out in the world, if we do that at the expense of some of our creative pursuits, then in fact, we shortchange ourselves. You know, if we want to, as we were saying before, solve the problems out in the world today, we actually need all of those creative skills. Those who do not learn history are doomed to repeat it. And no matter how fancy our formulas may be, if we do not become wise to what we've done before and what has gone wrong before, then we are looking forward to recreating that history, whether it was good or bad. So I think it is a mistake to say one area of knowledge is more important than all of the rest. I think it's that unity that's much more important and needs to be valued.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm speaking to Eddie Wu, Australia's leading mathematics educator and communicator. We'll be back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Eddie Wu. He's from Australia with Malaysian roots. Just a hint of him. And he's Australia's leading mathematics educator. He's a recipient of many awards. He won Australia's Local Hero Award at the Australian of the Year Awards. That was in January last year. And then in March, he was named as a top 10 finalist in the Global Teacher Prize. All accolades for a very young man who's done extraordinary things, at least in the field of math. Now, you're a teacher. You're a teacher, and I remember you're Cherrybrook. What a beautiful name for a school. Cherrybrook. Teachers in Australia. Tell us about teachers in Australia. Are teachers in Australia empowered to be stakeholders in discussions about education policy? Are there feedback mechanisms? Mm. How involved are teachers in shaping what happens in schools?
Teachers in Australia have this great opportunity to always provide their voice in all of our, for example, syllabus design processes. We always have a consultation period where every teacher gets the same weight as an organisation that's really large. They can put in their submission, put lots of time and thought and effort into that, and it goes into the official record and it gets produced in the ministerial report. We still have a long way to go, though, where teachers can actually become decision makers who are at the table and having, I think, the kind of voice that they need to really shift and guide what's happening in the classroom, because they are eminently qualified to do that, being the people doing the work themselves.
So they don't have autonomy. Are you saying with regard to the school, the curriculum, that's where they lack, they're not empowered? Is that what you're saying?
So it's a complicated picture. I want to resist, you know, the oversimplification of saying, look, they just have no power, because that's not true. But at the same time, there's a long way to go still, and let me illustrate this. I was talking about the syllabus consultation period that happens. Very recently, we had new syllabuses introduced in mathematics, English, science, and history for Form 5 and Form 6 students. And so the whole curriculum, for some areas, in the first time in decades, was really radically changed and shifted. Now, many changes were made, many changes were suggested, and then teachers had months to have a look at that, to diagnose it, to dissect it and say, these are things which we think are great, these are changes which we think clearly need a bit more thought, and there were real changes made in response to those teachers' suggestions. So no one can say, oh, teachers have no opportunity, teachers are silent, they have no opportunity to have an influence on what they are teaching. But at the same time, there are lots of decisions that are made which are not to do with what is best for students, which sometimes there are lots of stakeholders in this decision-making process. Education is something that everyone cares about, and often teachers, despite being the ones who are going to implement the curriculum and teach them to students, don't get the opportunity to say what they need to say.
Who's the most powerful voice in education in Australia? Is it the parents? Are the parents the ones who are determining things? Are they politicians who have taken those positions?
It's a really interesting and more dynamic landscape is what I would say. I mean, you mentioned parents, you mentioned politicians. In addition to those, I would add universities. There's an incredible voice from the tertiary sector, which has a lot to say about what kinds of students we want exiting our secondary schools, and that's a very fair call to make. I mean, one of the things that we were really worried about was students who were coming out of school, and they were not prepared for engineering courses, which required really significant advanced levels of mathematics. And so, rightly so, they have a voice at the table. And then, of course, we also have industry. Industry wants to make sure they have people who have the right skills, who are numerate, who can make decisions and also work together with other people.
Okay, you know, what about the question of, research? Is there much research happening so that when you formulate a policy or you're looking at the curriculum or you're looking at, what actually is transforming the learning experience for the young person or transforming outcomes, is there much research and who's doing it?
In Australia, this is a growing field. I think the Mathematical Education Research Group in Australia, MERGA, as we affectionately call it.
Oh, it's actually called that, MERGA.
That's what its actual name is. It has been meeting for decades, and it is a very powerful force. However, at the same time, I hasten to say, we are overshadowed by places like the US and the UK, which obviously have advantages of scale. But even without, when we take that factor out of the equation, pardon the pun, they are doing a lot more work in terms of researching innovative practices, looking at evidence-based sort of, is this assessment style actually helping our students learn? We know we can get really good data out of it, but does it help students have a more positive experience in the classroom that actually equips them in the workforce? Those questions are ones which we are struggling to answer in places like Australia, and it's not enough to look at overseas context. If there's one thing I've learned about looking at education systems around the world, whether it's Dubai or Uganda or here in Malaysia, it's that no matter which great system you look at, Finland, Shanghai, Singapore, etc., you cannot simply take their ideas and their research and drop them into your own context. The
Why
cultural
not?
Differences.
Well, okay, cultural differences. So when it comes to math education, we had a controversy in this country some years ago where the government tried to push the learning, not of math, but of English, and they decided that it was going to be the vehicle for that would be science and math. So there was pushback because they said, and people who were against this said, in fact, math is best learnt in the mother tongue. Now, is that the kind of conversation you're having in Australia? I mean, are those cultural issues really that significant in the way kids learn something like math? Which seems to be about symbols kind of beyond language, as it were. It's a language of its own.
One of my favourite quotes is from the scientist and mathematician and physicist, Galileo Galilei. He said, mathematics is the language with which God has written the universe. And I think that that is true. It is, in some ways, universal and beyond. In fact, one of the things that's come out of the videos that I've put on YouTube, which I've been delightfully surprised by, is that even though I teach the Australian curriculum, and I teach it in an eminently Australian accent, in fact, only 8% of my viewers are from Australia, and everyone else is around the world, and that speaks to the universality of mathematics. But coming to the question of culture, I mean, for me, I mean culture in a very broad sense. You asked before about the idea of, what language do we deliver mathematics in? In Australia, that specific question is not being asked, but that's because, and this is again, this is what I mean by cultural difference. If we look at a place like Australia and compare it to, say, Finland. Finland, of course, because of its results in global assessments like PISA and TIMSS, has gained, rightfully, a lot of attention. But a lot of people don't notice the fact that Finland is a trilingual country. Almost every person speaks three languages, not that dissimilar to here, but for different reasons. Europe, of course, is its own environment. Australia, by contrast, is essentially a single language system. Now, that's actually really important. The ability to be fluent in multiple languages is a huge asset when it comes to learning another language like mathematics. So which language do we offer it in, I think, is less an important question than what's the environment of a student's mind, what's the landscape in there that fits them better or poorer for learning the language of mathematics.
Okay, I have a really big question for you, but we're running out of time. I'm going to come back to the next section. I want to get your sense of what ought to change. If I had a magic wand and I made you the Minister of Education, what would you do? And that's coming up in the next section. Stay tuned to Let's Talk. Welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Eddie Wu, Australia's leading mathematics educator, communicator. And if I was, if I woke up tomorrow as Prime Minister of the country, I would make him the Minister of Education, and I would audition you first, and I would say to you, what would you do for math education in this country, or any country? Let's assume it's a country, a nameless country. What would you do?
I'm going to throw two big ideas at you, and they are radical, but in an environment like today, where we have so many students coming out of our mathematics classrooms vehemently disliking the subject, I think that calls for radical change. So my first suggestion would be, I really think assessment needs to undergo a transformation.
So the exam system.
Correct. In fact, I think the whole idea of exams, while they do have value, I don't want to get rid of exams, but if they are the only way that our students experience, have their knowledge and have their skill measured, I think, in fact, we are giving them a... we are getting a very false representation of their mathematical skill. And time and time again, and if there are any teachers watching tonight, I think they would, this would resonate with them. I sometimes have to write a report comment that sounds a little bit like, Sharad is an effective mathematician in class, but this result does not reflect his true ability. Because they sit an exam, it's under time pressure, it's all about memory, and suddenly students are very stressed, their fight or flight response kicks in, and actually that has been demonstrably shown in research to really diminish their mathematical ability under pressure. And we know many of the problems that we want to solve today that require mathematics. No one's got a 3-hour timer on you. No one is saying you're not allowed to consult any kind of textbook or you can't look at the internet. You need to have every single one of those formulas in your brain. That is a completely contrived situation. And so in addition to exams, which are very helpful, I want to have a diverse range of assessments that allow students to actually show how well they can communicate mathematically, show how well they can actually work alongside others and devise a solution to a problem they have never ever encountered before. So number one, I want to change the way we assess. Number two, I think the way that teachers in the classroom need to relate to their students, particularly in mathematics, really is in long need for a fundamental change.
My math teacher was at Form 1, was very strict, and all I remember was that. She was very strict. That's unfortunate. I don't know if being strict and teaching math come together.
I hope they don't. I really, really hope that the main memory my students have is not about strictness or anything like that. And that memory, I think, is telling.
Okay, so what would you do for the teacher and in that classroom situation? What is it that you would want?
So, I mean, you commented, you know, it's not just about Malaysia or Australia, or a broader context. I think that something that is true in every culture around the world is that teaching is something which happens by way of relationship. It's by way of rapport. If I don't have a good, solid connection with a student, if I don't know what matters to them, what makes them tick, if they don't know a bit about me and my personality, it's actually very difficult for genuine learning to happen. I might be able to convey facts into your brain. I may be able to show you a skill and you can mechanically follow it, but real learning, learning that will stay with you for the rest of your life, that is very difficult to create without a strong personal relationship. So what I want teachers to be able to have, and they need to be provided with the support to do this. It's not their fault now. They are very busy, distracted, time-poor professionals. And so developing this new skill is often the last thing on their mind. But we need to develop the idea of communication within the classroom, listening skills and questioning skills. I mean, we spend a lot of time on developing technology, and I think that's great. Central to the innovative way to teach mathematics. But if you took every computer out of my classroom, every scientific calculator out of my classroom, an entire school, and instead you taught those teachers to be really effective and incisive questioners. This is as ancient as Socrates. But that skill, that really helps to engender deep understanding.
And that does not happen in teacher training?
It doesn't happen nearly enough. I think we get a taste of it. You know, our sense of educational psychology for me was 6 months out of 4 years in my degree, and I got a sense of what it was about, but I had very little opportunity to actually hone that skill. That all happened when I was in the classroom, and for some teachers, they do not have the support, particularly if they're in a rural or remote area, to be able to develop that skill and have good role models. They need that support underneath them to professionally develop.
Okay, so we have exams. we want to get rid of them, or we want to diversify.
Exactly.
That's okay.
Thank you.
And then we have teachers. We want to empower them to be the best kind of teacher to deliver the subject. What else would you do?
Okay.
Well, Minister of Education, remember, your time's running out and, you know, and your job's on the line.
Okay. I'll go for the biggest one last. Really, what's going to change the way that education works, not just in Malaysia or Australia, but around the world, is that the status and regard of teachers has to be completely flipped on its head. I mean, you stated right at the beginning of the show that teaching is a profession that is highly denigrated around the world, and this is tragic. I mean, in a country that offers compulsory education, for which so many students go through school, I think that's a wonderful thing. I think education is a human right. But an unfortunate side effect is that many people feel like, I went to school, I know how to be a teacher, I'm an expert at this because I was there and I had my own experience. Now, part of that is true, but a part of that is gravely mistaken. Educational professionals need to be held in high regard. And of course, I would say that as a teacher, but when we don't do that, when we have a society in which who do we, you know, bring into the teaching profession? People who struggled and couldn't accomplish in other areas, so they came to this as a matter of second or third or last resort. Then we cannot be surprised by that lack of investment in the next generation, that we as a society don't pay for that. We don't want to have those consequences of teachers who aren't supported, who aren't passionate and dedicated and academically capable. We don't want to face the consequences of lacking those people in the profession. So if we want to change that, we need to change the status and regard of teachers.
Okay, I'm not sure if it's entirely in the power of governments to do that, because this is about society, isn't it?
True.
And also what societies measure success. If it's the paycheck at the end of the month, teachers aren't being paid very well, then, of course, society tends to value them less. Mm. But, you know, things have changed. My mother was a teacher. She taught English and literature. And, you know, I'm very glad that she did. It's made me a better person for it. Now, in the remaining minutes that we have, Eddie, I do want to ask you this. And there's a question about teaching as well. You know, you have a class and you have a wonderful, you know, an exciting time and experience with them, and the kids move on. As a teacher, where is the possibility for personal growth? What does it mean for a teacher to grow in their profession so that it's not repetitive? It's not just, yeah, new faces, same old curriculum.
I want to relay a story to you, Sharad, that I think perfectly captures how positive we can be about this particular question you ask. When I started my teaching career, I think it was the first week, I came through 5 days of teaching and I was exhausted. Every day I got home at, you know, 5 p.m. and I just hit the bed. And I sort of got up in a fog at 11 at night and I thought, what day is it, you know? I was exhausted and I met a friend on the weekend and he said to me, hey, how's your first week of work? And I said, I am exhausted, but I'm so satisfied and delighted by the opportunity I have to make a difference in the lives of young people. And this friend of mine, this is years ago now, he looked at me straight in the eye and said, I give you 6 weeks. 6 weeks, and then I think you're going to be my grizzled, old, tired, cynical teacher, and you're going to say, full-time work is terrible. Now, here I am more than 11 years later, and every day I feel like I discover new things, new reasons, new ways to grow into this profession, and new things that surprise and delight me. Now, how do we do this? I think there's at least two big ways. Number one, when we teach an old concept. I mean, mathematics is an ancient art, but we can constantly teach it in new ways. I mean, one of the things that I've fallen into is that by videoing my lessons and putting them online, when I come back to teach a concept that I've taught before, I have a real motivation to say, I want another way to teach this. I want to
Because you're like a standard comic, can't do the same jokes every
time. Yeah, that's exactly right. It's kind of like, they'll say to me, you've done this before. I've watched that video. I want a new experience. And I also myself do not want to become bored. Mathematics is a rich subject. You can look at it from so many different angles. I like to compare mathematics topics to diamonds. Every time you look at a different perspective, you get a whole new spectrum of colours if you're willing to change your perspective.
Right, so that's your personal curiosity about the subject that you're delivering to the kids. Final minutes that we have, what would be the next thing that you say to teachers?
The next thing is to continue growing in your journey as an educator. I mean, one of the things that I've been delightfully surprised by is how much joy and satisfaction I've gained from not working directly with children, but being able to support other teachers in their work with children and realizing I can have a broader impact. I'm now old enough, when I look at some of the young teachers who are coming into the profession, I think, hold on, I'm old enough to be your teacher. You guys are just kids. I'm now already the next generation. And so I have a responsibility to share the great lessons and mentorships that were given to me and to pass that on. And that's a way to continue developing and growing and rising through this education profession. There are so many opportunities for growth.
Okay, wonderful. And because you have a book, it's Wu's A Wonderful World of Maths. Excuse the alliteration, but you know, I wanted to ask you, is there a movie deal coming up?
Can you try? Look, at the moment,
documentary perhaps on Netflix?
Potentially. There might maybe a Netflix original series. Is Netflix paying attention? Maybe. Yeah. There is a TV series that we produced on children's TV in Australia that is all about developing an understanding of financial literacy, using mathematical skills in a concrete context. I don't think Hollywood's buying yet, but who knows?
Who knows? Thank you so much. Eddie Wu. Eddie Wu, who was named top 10 finalist in the Global Teacher Prize, also the recipient of Australia's Local Hero Award at the Australian of the Year Awards. A man committed to communicating the joys and the wonders of mathematics. This has been Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutin, only on Astro 1E.